You're listening to heritageradionetwork.org. This is a live recording from the Roger Smith Cookbook Conference.
We are in the pop-up studio of the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and I'm in the studio with Joe Yonan, the food and travel editor of the Washington Post, as well as the author of Serve Yourself, which came out in 2011, and Eat Your Vegetables, which will be published this coming summer, right?
Yep, in August. You can tell I like the imperative titles. I tell people what to do.
People need guidance, Joe.
Yes,
they need
they
it.
Do.
Absolutely.
Yes, they do.
So since you have carved out a little niche for yourself with this single serve meals, tell me a little bit about that, because as you pointed out in the previous conversation, most recipes are written for 4, 6, or 8 people.
That's right. Yeah. So I really got into it because I got tired of hearing people say, whenever I ask single friends what they made for themselves, I got tired of hearing them say, why would I go to all that trouble if it's just me? And I always think that there's really no such thing as just you. You know what I mean? I mean, maybe it's just that I'm on the narcissistic side, but...
I haven't noticed that.
Oh, good. I'm hiding it well.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I just think that there's nobody more important to feed than myself. And as much as I love entertaining and cooking for people and cooking for friends or family or people that I'm dating or anything like that, you know, a few nights a week, I'm alone in the kitchen with an eggplant, as Lori Colon put it in that great essay. And on those nights, my standard doesn't change for how interesting I want the food to be.
Sure.
But you're right that the majority of cookbooks feature recipes that serve 4 to 6. And so that means that for single people, it's a big question of leftovers, among other obstacles. For a couple, you know, who makes a recipe for 4, they have only one night of leftovers. And if I make a recipe for 4 on a night that I'm cooking for myself, I have 3 meals of leftovers. You know, in that first meal, like I make a lasagna, let's say. You know, I make it for dinner that night, and then for lunch that next day, I feel ahead of the game. I'm like, ooh, I've got some of that lasagna, you know, from last night. Yeah, yum. For dinner that night, I come home and I'm like, wait a minute, didn't I have that lasagna for lunch today?
Yeah.
And then the next day, I'm just angry about
it. I'm over it.
Yeah, I'm angry.
Yes. What about freezing it?
Well,
never as good when you defrost.
Well, right. And I have sort of a short attention span, so I want to eat different things all the time. And I feel like that's one of the great joys, you know, in cooking, is getting to explore different things all the time. So, and for me, if I put something in the freezer, even if I label it, I push it to the back, and I forget it's there, and then 6 months later, it's some
when you defrost
thing.
The refrigerator,
right.
The freezer, you discover the mystery meat package.
Right.
Thing. Oh my God, I don't even know what that is.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So instead, what I kind of like to do is to think about making building blocks that I can use in other recipes. So, you know, on the weekends when I have more time, I'll cook a pot of beans. And then I'll refrigerate maybe half of them, and the other half I'll freeze in little quart-sized Ziploc bags. And then I can pull out, you know, a single serving of that at a time, and I can use that to make a quick soup, or I can make a really nice grain vegetable salad with beans in it, all sorts of things that I can do with those. And I do that with things like greens. I braise a bunch of greens at once and save them, you know, certainly big brown rice, big pots of rice, or even tofu, things like that.
Uh-huh. Cool strategies.
Yeah.
That's great. And things like stocks, obviously,
or
anything that you can freeze in little cubes.
Yep.
Or
yep.
I even do some flavor boosters.
Yeah, absolutely. I even do some soup bases, I call them. So they're sort of like homemade Campbell's concentrated soup. So I make a really potent, like I do a sweet potato one that's a roasted sweet potato, and that I then cook on the stovetop with aromatic vegetables, and then it's thick, like a almost looks like something you would serve at a Thanksgiving table. It's
mm-hmm.
It's
almost a puree.
Yeah, and then I freeze that, and it makes 4 quart size servings, and I, not quart, I'm sorry, like cup size servings.
Mm-hmm.
and then I freeze those individually, and then when I want to have soup, I pull one out, I defrost it, I thin it out, and I can take it in lots of different directions. I can do one that's got thinned out with a little orange juice and some pecans and some smoked paprika and a little creme fraiche, or I can
do, my mouth is watering.
You know, that I can take the same soup base and do like chickpeas, chorizo, and kale, and thin it out that way.
Sure.
So basically, it's got all this deep flavor because the time I put into it when I had time, but then it tastes fresh because I just made it.
Yeah,
and
I think
quick.
It's brilliant.
Yeah,
absolutely brilliant. I have to get this book.
Yes, you do.
Not that I'm single, because I do cook for my 16-year-old too, who's got quite a discerning palate. But yeah, she keeps me on the hop. Let's talk a little bit about being the food and travel editor for the Washington Post.
Sure.
How, you know, food pages have really changed in the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. Why don't you take us through some of the things that have happened besides the downsizing of the staff? I mean, now you probably wear four hats where you once wore one or one and a half, right?
Right. Well, you know, I think just in my title, you can tell I'm food and travel editor of
That's
the Post. Long ago, looking farther back, I mean, there was certainly a time when food sections or food pages of newspapers were considered to be the ladies' pages. You know, that was domestic home territory. But over the last 10, 15 years, I think a lot of food sections have reflected the growth of interest in food generally, and you've seen much more coverage of restaurants, and certainly as the chef culture has exploded, you've seen more coverage of chefs as personalities, and then there's food is certainly big news too, you know, food policy, as you deal with on your show a lot, draws in environmental issues, health issues. Mm-hmm. And at the Post, we try to cover a lot of those aspects of food, and also food as culture and history.
Sure.
But you're right, over the last 10 years, there's certainly been a lot of pressures on food sections. And a lot of papers have either put them in other places or consolidated them or certainly reduced staff. We still have a standalone food section on Wednesdays that's 6 to 8 pages, which is really great. It's certainly smaller than it used to be, but it's still a lot bigger than a lot of sections out there, which is nice. But I have a pretty tight staff now. Yeah, it's my deputy editor Bonnie Benwick is fantastic.
And she is fantastic.
Yeah, very hardworking.
Yeah.
And I have a fantastic staff writer, Tim Carman.
Also, Tim went from
the City Paper. Yeah, I got
to
him.
The Post. So yeah. he's a regular now. That's
great. Yeah, yeah.
He's a Facebook friend, and I used to do a lot of slacking with him. He's a great guy.
Yeah, he's a really great guy.
Yeah.
He just in tomorrow's food section. Wait, I'm sorry. In next week's food section, I'm a little mixed up here because I've been looking at page proofs from New York on my iPhone. he has a really fantastic piece on fried whiting in D.C. as a cultural story. Mm-hmm. It's very, very common in the African-American communities and sort of, you know, Northwest quadrant official Washington doesn't really see it as much. And so it's a really, so he tells a story about how it came to be so popular in urban African-American areas and where the fish comes from, and it's a really, really good read. It's exactly why I hired him.
Do you think that something like that, okay, that speaks to something that we were talking about earlier in the conference, which was about trends and trend spotting, and sometimes when something like that, fried whiting, gets attention or exposure in a section like yours, it then starts to trend or starts to become popular in other demographics. Do you see a lot of examples of that? I mean, using fried whiting as one example, but I'm sure that there are other ones. I mean, I feel like the interest in kale, for instance, or collard greens,
or something like that,
black-eyed peas, beans, legumes. I mean, all of those seem to me to sort of come via that sort of cultural path.
I mean, I think that with a lot of foods, one of the reasons that they get the attention of chefs is because there's a particular cultural richness to them. And so with something like with fried whiting, it's interesting. I'm not sure that it's going to make any kind of leap into
mainstream restaurant cooking.
Right, or upscale, certainly. Mm-hmm. But it is an example of a way of eating and a really popular dish that maybe a lot of people don't think about and don't realize that it's there. You know, everybody in D.C. thinks about the half smoke as being, you know, this popular thing in D.C. and the signature dish of D.C. and the jumbo pizza slice. But that's a those are very particular audiences necessarily, and this is a different one.
Right.
There have been definitely some examples of certainly foods that were thought of as lower end, lower rent foods, like chicken and waffles, for instance.
Yeah,
that would be
a great example.
That would be a good example. And it certainly has jumped into kind of chefy popular culture in a lot of cities.
Yeah.
Fried chicken donuts.
Sure. Even things like sausages, to me, have become much more of a sort of upper or fine dining experience with, you know, much more exotic ingredients, rabbit sausage or venison sausage or, you know, what have you. Yeah, it's really, that's fascinating.
And I think that these kinds of trends are so interesting because if you think back, you know, maybe 20 or 30 years ago and you think about steak, for instance, remember how it was always considered to be the kind of primo steak was like a filet mignon.
Yeah.
And it was because it was buttery and tender, but I think people started realizing, you know what, it doesn't actually taste like all that much of anything.
Right, you had to wrap it in bacon.
Right.
And serve it with béarnaise.
Right. And then chefs kind of realized that there was an appetite for people who were interested in more interesting tastes. Mm-hmm. But that, I think that's also partly because connected to the growth and travel, too.
Growth and travel, and also the filet mignon represented a certain echelon of the socioeconomic stratosphere.
Yes.
So the filet was considered the creme de la creme, and then the lower or lesser steaks, chuck steak or something like that, was very much more low rent. And then I don't even know if they called things New York Strip or... They called them Delmonico's for the ribeye, right? That was an early name, an early moniker for the rib steak. I don't know, having that butchering background, you know, I was selling steaks in the late 80s and early 90s. And, you know, at that time, the interest in grass-fed literally didn't exist.
Right.
I mean, I worked with a French couple, and we sold meat, which we proudly proclaimed to be from Montfort of Colorado, and only to find, as I began researching the cattle industry, that that was the very first feedlot.
Wow. Labeling.
Yeah, it was really interesting, you know, and we thought that was great, and it was great compared to supermarket meat that people could buy in the supermarket. It was definitely a cut or two above, no question about it.
So to speak.
But it's thank you. But yeah, it's really interesting to me how these like certain, you know, cuts of meat or certain types of poultry you know, fed into an idea of luxury or upper class, you know, mores or whatever, and then other things kind of didn't, and then now it's reversed. Beef cheeks, and it's ossobuco, and, you know,
and
all the peasant food, and offal, all of that stuff. So fascinating. I have one more question to ask you, and then I'm going to wrap this up, but as you know, I do have an abiding interest in sort of food policy and politics and the food industry in general. And I mean by that, I mean big food, big agriculture, General Mills, you know, like all of those guys.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see in food sections in general as much coverage of those topics.
Mm-hmm.
For example, antibiotics in the meat supply,
mm-hmm.
which is, according to some of the scientists I've interviewed, the most pressing public health crisis like right this minute that we are facing, and yet there is relatively little. I don't know about the Post, but the Times may have covered it, you know, a few times, but the articles are usually kind of small, whereas the Kansas City Star, did you see that three-part series they did this fall?
Mm-hmm.
That was like a really in-depth examination of every aspect of the cattle industry, and I thought, you know, bravo, okay, Kansas, you know, it's a cattle state, but still, like, I feel like some of these topics need and deserve that kind of attention. And I wondered if it was a question of, like, do you not think your readers would be interested, or is it an economic issue in which advertisers, for instance, would not support that kind of reporting?
No.
What do you think is the, do you think it's more that consumers just aren't that interested in those kinds of stories?
I mean, I think it's probably, there's a lot of reasons for it. I think that in the post, we try to tap into those issues from time to time, but we're also trying to cover a lot of aspects of food. But I also will say that in the post, you'll see stories like that in other parts of the paper, too.
Mm-hmm.
And
same in New York, in the New York Times, actually.
Yeah, and I think that that's partly just because often those stories are timely.
Yeah.
And sometimes when you have a weekly section, it's hard to key the time to the exact deadlines of the weekly section. So it ends up meaning that you can't put, you know, really tight timeline pieces in the food section as easily as you can in the daily section. But a lot of it, too, is personnel-based, definitely. You know, there's reporters at the Post who have the contacts with those agencies and the background to write about those issues who aren't writing for the food section. I think that's part of it.
I just think that it should be in the food section more, I guess is my point. And yes, it's fine if it goes into the business section, because of course it is big business. We're talking about major money and, you know, a large part of our economic, you know, total here, our GDP. But I think it's interesting that, you know, consumers are horrified when they see Food Inc. or something like that. But that information is out there, and it's been out there. And, you know, it would be, I think, from my point of view, it would be interesting to see food sections be more political about things like that.
We do a monthly piece by Jane Black.
She's terrific.
Who used to be on my staff. Mm-hmm. And she's spotlighting, it's called Smarter Food, and she's trying to write about solutions, I would say. People who are doing interesting programs that support the idea of sustainability.
Mm-hmm.
And then we did a big series on obesity that the whole paper did. And the food section got involved with some of that. And we sponsored a big food policy conference the Post did a couple of years ago. So it's definitely an issue that we're interested in. But I was at a conference. I hosted a conference of the Association of Food Journalists in D.C. in September, and we did a food policy panel. And I had Helen Botemiller from Food Safety Journal.
Bill Marler's organ.
She was fantastic.
She is fantastic. She's a great writer, and she really does a good job. She's also been working with the Food and Environmental Reporting Network. I don't know if you know that.
I do know them. Yeah. Sam Fromarts and I are friends. And Sam was on the panel, and Jane was, and Phil Brasher was on the panel. And we were talking about this a lot because most of the attendees were newspaper food journalists. But their staffs have all shrunk so much that they just don't have the resources. And so we were trying to give them pointers on, like, ways they can dip into the subject without investing a huge amount of time.
Right.
So hopefully, I'm hoping that inspires
them. Well, I hope that will, you know, that this kind of continues to populate the food pages. Because I do understand the constraints. I mean, I don't mean to be accusatory about this.
No, I know.
And it's also a fairly new trend, if you will.
Right.
You know, because 5 years ago, people just wanted to read about star chefs, you know.
Right.
Now, all of a sudden, they're worried about where their food's coming from.
Right.
So, it is relatively new. Well, with that, Joe Yonan from the Washington Post, I thank you so, so much for joining me today.
You're welcome.
It's been a great pleasure chatting with you. I hope you'll come and visit and come do a show with me at the station.
I'd love to.
Out at Roberta's in our shipping containers.
I'd love to.
Yeah, it's great.
I'd love to.
Okay,
thank
you so much.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, iTunes, and Stitcher for more. Visit our website, heritageradionetwork.org, for all of our 30-plus weekly podcasts. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.